So we're happy to have
for
the first speaker of our second session, Sarah Shandera, who's going to talk about large-scale CFB anomalies as a signature of non-Gaussianity.
Okay, thanks a lot to the organizers, especially because I'm definitely in the other large-scale. What did you call it? Other large-scale novelties. Yeah, this is definitely a novelty. So anyway, so this is work that's done. It's just waiting for one of the authors to get back from vacation to actually post it. With Adrian Erichek and my student Saroz, and it's really Saroz who took this sort of vague idea, yes, you should look at this, and came up with all the results that I'm going to present. So it's largely his work.
It's been about his vacation.
Take a guess. It's not me. All right. Maybe it is. All right, so I'm going to talk about the sort of convolution of two things in the CMB. One is non-Gaussianity, and the other is statistical isotropy. So just to remind you basically what those two things are, very roughly, non-Gaussianity says we only need the two-point function. That's all the information that we need to characterize the fluctuations. In this case, I'm going to be talking about the fluctuations in the CMB temperature field. This is an expression essentially in real space where n is the direction that I'm looking. So n delta t in direction n hat, delta t in direction n hat prime. And the claim of isotropy in this context is that that quantity only depends on the angle between those two points and n hat prime. So you'd think ideally that these are two completely separate aspects of data analysis. You can have a field that's anisotropic but Gaussian, or non-Gaussian but isotropic, either or both. What I'm going to claim is that in the context of our CMB, and this is not a new claim, but I'm going to sort of make it very formal, is that you don't really separate those two things entirely. If you have a field, particularly that's non-Gaussian, and especially if that field has fluctuations on wavelengths larger than what we observe in our CMB sky, then in fact you naturally expect some level of anisotropy in the sky that we see, which goes a long way, I think, potentially toward explaining what are sometimes called the anomalies. I'm going to work a lot in harmonic space. So just as a reminder, we can take this delta T temperature field, expand it in the spherical harmonics on the sky, and ask about these coefficients ALM. And in this context, the statement of Gaussianity and isotropy is just this one, that if I look at the correlation of those A and A star, LM, L prime, M prime, this is the only interesting combination. It's all in these CLs. And so that's the usual plot that you see of the CMB power. All right. One of the most interesting so-called anomalies of the CMB sky is this power asymmetry. So what is that? It's basically this idea that there is a line that you can divide the sky into. And on one half of the sky, the fluctuations of various multipoles, not all multipoles, but some large scale fluctuations, have overall a different average power than the fluctuations on the other half of the sky. So this is actually a map of the variance, the local variance, with the line drawn to try to figure out what is the direction, what is the split between the low and the high variance fluctuations. And so you've got more blue stuff here, more red stuff here, more low, more high fluctuations. Different amount of power. There are lots of different ways to represent this. There are lots of different statistics. If you don't have a model, there are lots of different statistics you can do to try to say what exactly is the way to characterize this and what exactly is the significance, all that sort of stuff. And that's a very messy, tricky business, which I'm not particularly interested in the details. What I'm interested in is making a model that I'm going to claim is a very natural way to predict a signal like this, and then data analysis people can go and figure out what's the best statistic to try to capture that model. So there are lots of ways that you might write an equation for the full signal. This is a very, very crude way of doing it, which certainly doesn't capture everything, especially if you take this A to be a constant. But basically, one way you can think about this is by taking those fluctuations in delta T and talking about the modulated fluctuations, where you take the isotropic part and you say it has a correction of some amplitude and some correlation with some special direction, p hat. So this is the special direction where you split the sky. This is the difference in power on those two halves, if you like, the difference in variance of power on those two halves. And if you look on large scales, a number that you might assign to this A for the sky that we see is something like 0.07. And you can think of lots of different ways to try to say, well, how significant is that? Is that a really rare event? Is that a not so rare event? And a lot of different analyses come up somewhere in the range of 3 sigma. So there are lots of people here, especially Kendrick, who are much CMB experts, much more than I am, who can tell you about details of this stuff. Also, this is kind of a nice paper because it gives this very intuitive local variance map picture of this anomaly. And then these, of course, are the Planck papers. Okay, so what? So this was, you know, me basically a year ago. You say, okay, three sigma, whatever. Not that unlikely, you know, you could have looked at 1,000 statistics. Some of them are three sigma, so whatever, I don't really care. Or you could say, oh, this is great, this is a large scale thing. Largest scales correspond to the beginning of inflation, maybe. So maybe there's some thing lurking just outside the horizon. It's the start of inflation, it's a giant texture, it's something. And this is the signature of that really unusual physics. And I'm excited about that because it's going to verify my model. That's a different perspective you could take. And I don't know, the fact that you need something really strange here, or it could be just a fluke here, is kind of strange. And maybe you think those are two not mutually exclusive reasons not to work on this. I don't know. Apologies to those of you who are aficionados, but that's a perspective you could take. So what I'm hoping, actually, is that there's a third option, which is that there's a rather innocuous extension of normal statistics that we have that actually tells you that you should get this at some level of significance. Of course, the two hard questions are, even if I tell you, well, it's not some, I don't have to put in some surprising physics on large scales or some special scale just outside our horizon to get the signature, you might still say, okay, but you have to also show me that that's more likely or there's more evidence for that scenario than the fact that it's just a three sigma fluke. So I'm going to try to address both of those issues in the rest of the talk.
Sorry, why is it B, then we don't have to work on it?
No, I guess I'm just saying if what you have to, so it's a three sigma fluke, but I'm going to put in some 10 sigma violation of normal statistics to explain a three sigma fluke, you know, some big fluctuation just outside the horizon. I mean, that could be cool if that's your taste, or you could say, well, you put in some really unusual thing just to explain a not that unusual. Yeah, I don't know. There are many, many, this is all on the level of taste here, so. Okay, so let me just remind you of one of the, sort of the foundation of one of the most successful and one of the most iterated upon ideas to explain this power asymmetry. And this is this paper of Eric Cech, Kamienkowski, and Carroll. So you see we've hooked in at least Eric Cech to our work, so that's a good sign. So basically the idea is this. You have some scenario where you generate the type of non-Gaussianity that couples long wavelength modes to short wavelength modes. So think of this as a curviton or some mixed curviton-inflaton. And you have some large amplitude superhorizon fluctuation. So this is a scale, you know, comparable, a little bit bigger than our Hubble scale. Very large amplitude fluctuation so that you get a big gradient across our sky. And where this fluctuation is bigger, you get, in this case, I guess that they've drawn some, a suppressed, which I think is the appropriate sign for the curviton, actually. You get a suppressed amplitude of fluctuations. And where this is a under, you know, down fluctuation, you get an increased amplitude of the curvature fluctuations. So this is a large scale that couples to the smaller scale stuff, and that's exactly what gives you this power asymmetry. So Adrian tells me that when they wrote down this model, in their original vision, this had to be a pretty large, crazy mode. It had to be like a 10 sigma fluctuation if Evanel is less than 100. So this is an example of one of these sort of beasts lurking outside the horizon where you have to have a pretty big fluctuation to explain the level of power asymmetry that we see. And this is the only paper I'm citing, but as you probably all know, there are probably 50 papers that I should and could list here that are basically iterations of ideas similar to this. So I apologize for not listing those. So what are we doing? What am I going to show you in this talk? Basically, what we're claiming is that we can write down an analytic expression predicting for you the probability of those types of modulations, that power asymmetry, from any isotropic non-Gaussian model. So basically, we're just computing the cosmic variance. If you have some model where you have non-Gaussianity, you expect to see these anisotropies, as I'm going to show you, we're predicting the probability that you see them. And this actually goes beyond the typical models you write down, because there's this nice paper about the pesky power asymmetry by Zhang, Kamienkowski, Liang Dai, I think. And basically, they say, you know, you have a gradient in something. Maybe you have a gradient in delta NS. Maybe you have a gradient in some other quantity that explains for you the power asymmetry. But all these things look like, you know, gradient coupled to short wavelength fluctuations. Some level, all these things look like non-Gaussianity. There's a long scale coupled to short scales. So basically, any model that you want to explain, I think I'm making a strong claim here, that's isotropic but non-Gaussian, which is basically any model that gives you this gradient coupled to small scales, is going to fall into this framework, and you can test that model against the data. What we're going to claim is when we do this cosmic variance analysis for, if you're okay with a slightly particular type of non-Gaussianity, which is not that particular, I'm going to argue, you don't need lurking superhorizon specialness. in order to bring down the significance of this anomaly. You just find that you get these asymmetries as a natural consequence of that non-Gaussianity. So that's a somewhat, I think, less special type of thing than invoking a beginning of inflation or texture or whatever. And again, that's a question of taste, whether you like that or not. This connection, these two points, basically mean that there are a couple things you can do. One thing you can do is you can use the power modulations to constrain non-Gaussianity. You can say this is the amplitude of power suppression and dipole asymmetry that we've seen, therefore constraints on FNL are blah. You can combine those with bispectrum constraints, all of that. What you'd really like to do, of course, is then say, is there any evidence for this non-Gaussian model versus the Gaussian model, right, that three sigma number? So as you might imagine, if I put in one parameter, I'm not going to get very good evidence for that model. If I start putting in more parameters where I've got correlated observables on different scales, you might be able to have some higher, some larger evidence for the non-Gaussian model over the Gaussian. But I think, you know, what this framework does, because we give you the model and we give you this probability distribution for these anisotropies, you can actually do a decent model comparison, because as you take FNL to zero or whatever your non-Gaussian is to zero, you recover, you know, the normal three sigma statistic that you would have for Gaussian fluctuations. So it's a fair way to do model comparison and get evidence for models. Okay. So basically what we're going to do is formalize this EKC paper. And a lot of people have done iterations of this paper where they just write down one particular supermode with some FNL and things like that. I'm going to claim that there's a way you can just write down every conceivable non-Gaussian model and get the effect on the power spectrum. Oh, and I should point out, you know, this FNL has to be the FNL that is not Modestina's consistency relation FNL. This is the rest of the FNL that gives you a genuine dipole. Anyway, and it's easy for FNL. For FNL case, it just looks like this. You have the power spectrum as a function of k. You have a contribution that's proportional to FNL that comes from integrating over the long wavelength stuff with this e to the I kx factor. And basically here, you know, we treat this as a distribution from which you draw your fluctuations. So even if I didn't have this term, I can draw realizations of this Gaussian isotropic field, and some of those realizations have power asymmetries. So this thing is stochastic. This is statistical. These things are specific values, specific realizations of the long wavelength field. So again, if I have, you know, a super volume, I can draw for you a distribution of those long wavelength modes and give you a distribution of what I should expect to find for this term. But of course, in our universe, there's one value of those modes, and we have no idea what it is. So the best we can do is predict the distribution and see if it's likely that. That
I'm yeah. Confused Sorry. About this formula. So you have yeah. there and x there.
That's right. That's right. So good. Great. So basically, what this means. So the power asymmetry described in Fourier spaces is very awkward, mm-hmm. right? You can't be a function of some special k. It has to be something else. It has to have this gradient idea. So basically what we've done is I can show you the derivation. Take the two-point function at, you know, compute the real space two-point function at two points separated by some distance r. And this is the right expression as long as those points don't have a big separation compared to the scale of the gradient. So then I can think of really a spatially dependent power spectrum. But really the Fourier transform only makes sense in, you know, those individual bits. So this is sort of a hybrid Fourier space real space.
So this only makes sense when kx is much bigger than one.
That's right, exactly. And so I can show you what happens otherwise, but
right.
That's right.
Okay. Good. And I'm just wondering. And so I guess the other thing that you want it to be, the modulation to be only on larger scale.
So I haven't accounted for that here. So this. That's right. So that's right. So this is not a correct model for various reasons.
Okay.
And one of those is that this is not scale dependent. So I'll come to that as.
You want to make that a scale.
Yeah. That's right. So basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to use this case to give you a lot of qualitative results because it's clearer, it's very clear, and then I'm going to extrapolate to a model that's a better fit to data and show you a similar set of results.
But I mean, that just, you're just going to make FNL a function of
A. We'll come to that, yeah. All right, so then all I'm going to do to connect it to usual formulisms is expand the exponential, get rid of that. What that looks like once I do that is that there's just some mode expansion here. So it's FNL with some mode expansion. And these coefficients here are where I've hidden that dependence on the long wavelength mode. So, you know, those things are some expansions with some Bessel functions. These are the long wavelength modes, and these are all integrals over the long wavelength stuff. Okay, so if I take the capital L equals zero bit of that, this is the monopole shift. So it's just some constant here. Proportional to FNL, some integral over long wavelength modes. This thing's kind of interesting. It's infrared sensitive, so actually it integrates over all the extra e-folds of inflation that you have. which is interesting if you're trying to compare your inflationary model to observations in a small volume. But for the purposes of this talk, that thing is unobservable, right? You don't know. We have one measurement. We have no idea what's the monopole and what was the natural isotropic part. So that we're just going to absorb into the rest of the formula. And once I do that, the nice thing is that this expression is even though it came from this sort of big universe picture where I'm doing fluctuations on large scales, this thing and this thing are really the power spectrum and the non-Gaussianity measured in my universe. So this formula now references stuff I measured and some amplitude of coefficient, which I don't know for the dipole, which I'm going to have to give you a probability distribution for. The other nice thing about this model is that the variance for the dipole, and I've taken capital L equal 1 here, is not infrared sensitive. It's suppressed. And that makes sense, right? Basically, you know, if I don't have very long wavelength modes, have relatively smaller gradients, if you like. So the only things that this is sensitive to are modes very near the horizon scale. So this model, this thing doesn't care how much extra E folds of inflation you've had, effectively. It just cares about gradients of modes that are near horizon scale because of this extra power of KLX suppressing it here. It's not true of all models, but that's true of the local model. Okay, so now we want to know what's the prediction for the dipole. And the way I'm going to connect that is by saying, well, you can imagine picking a direction D in the sky and asking what's the amplitude of the power asymmetry. So this is the dipolar power asymmetry across that direction, D, here. And connecting that to our formula in terms of, you know, the ALMs, the YLMs, you find that AI is just F and L and some, you know, number you can compute, which is again some integral over long wavelength stuff suppressed, you know, so the very long wave stuff, these contributions are suppressed. Of course, that direction is completely arbitrary, right? So what I really want to do is decompose whatever line of asymmetry there is into its orthogonal, three orthogonal components, and report for you the amplitude of the asymmetry across the largest line, right? So I'm really going to report for you capital A, which is related to the components, as you would expect.
But the capital A now, essentially, it's a random variable.
What's that? Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
So I'm going to show you the distributions for all these guys. But these guys are essentially Gaussian distributed. And then what I really want to report for you is the value of capital A. Yeah, I know this is a subject that has lots of intricacies, so please ask me any questions that you have. So basically, if I combine those guys to get a distribution, I get a Maxwell distribution for capital A. The variance of that thing is given by something that isn't zero in the Gaussian case, right? Even in the Gaussian case, I expect some distribution of asymmetries in my maps. So we're going to measure that from Gaussian maps. But then this quantity is the number that we can predict. This is the variance of that quantity that I showed you. It's this integral over long wavelength modes that we can calculate. And we're going to compare these things to some simple CMB maps to check that this formula fits. And then that gives you a way of calculating the probability of the asymmetry in your model. So these are realizations. They're very simplified realizations. They're just Sachs-Wolfe approximation simulations.
This is just a dipole, right?
I'm just showing you the dipole.
In the sense, like, it's a dipole of the Sachs-Wolfe perspective. Because it's just a dipole of phi.
Yes.
Is it on the last scattering surface?
Yeah, that's right. So I guess what I didn't say is I computed it for general x, but then I'm taking x to be on the last scattering surface. Yeah.
And
So basically, for any direction that you pick on the sky, as you expect, most maps have no significant asymmetry in that direction. But then there's this big spread. And as you add more non-Gaussianity, that spread gets bigger. But if you take any given map and you ask, now there is some direction across which there is a maximal asymmetry, right? So you take your map and you scan through and you find the direction of maximal asymmetry and you ask, how big is that asymmetry? And then even for Gaussian maps, you know, that's non-zero. It's A of about 0.02. And as you increase the non-Gaussianity, you're adding that extra term, that extra variance term that we've computed from these gradient modes. And the value of that asymmetry gets bigger because you've coupled your local modes to gradient modes. And basically, these things are just showing these are our histograms, and that's that probability distribution that I gave for you. So you can trust that probability distribution. And everything I'm going to show you works as long as things are relatively weakly non-Gaussian and A0 is not too big. Yes. Except this is our approximation for the CMB. So it's not quite the right number. So basically the number that, if you use the p-value for the anomaly, the number that we think by p-value-wise corresponds to the CMB measurement, it's 0.055. So.
I'm confused about this. You had to multiply A by FNL to get the point relation. In your previous formula, didn't you?
FNL is in there. No, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Oh, maybe I made a typo, actually. Good point. So FNL is in there. It's okay, FNL with the...
So then at zero FNL, A would be zero.
It's not, right? Because even in realizations, even of Gaussian maps, you can always find a direction across which there's some asymmetry.
But that's the definition of A, isn't it?
But this is also I'm supposed to draw the map from the Gaussian, from this distribution. So maps that are drawn from this distribution don't necessarily have no A. And the way that we've folded that in is by saying that there's also this Gaussian variance in this distribution. So as I take FNL to zero, what's left is just what you measure as the probability of getting this asymmetry from Gaussian maps.
So it's basically isotropic. Saying you pick one directional CMB, right? You calculate the local CMB power spectra, and you calculate the quadrupole of this quantity, right? It's not going to be zero in any time.
Dipolar.
Right. Well, quadrupole.
Okay, so that means that previous formula you had was not correct, and you said AI is...
That's the mean.
That's
the mean, and you have to draw realizations around that.
Okay, so then you should have said that's the mean, then. By then, I'm a bit... Okay, if that's true...
The rest of that stuff is a stochastic... The Gs are stochastic variables.
Okay.
So those are meant to be... Yeah, sorry, maybe it's not completely transparent notation. Okay, so that's, you know, if you take this idea of this asymmetry, that's not all that expected. As you increase the level of non-Gaussianity, you expect to get a bigger asymmetry.
And none of this accounts for the look elsewhere
business. No, of course, no, because I'm taking a particular model and I'm calculating all of its effects. And I've given you the formula for all of the effects of the long wavelength mode, so you can calculate any statistic you like and compare it to my model. Yeah. So, good. But I am going to come to the model comparison in a second. So, like I said, we can do two things with this. One is we can just use this to constrain FNL, right? We've seen some value of the asymmetry. What does that mean?
The observed ASR was like 0.05
something. Yeah, I'm going to show you here in a second. Yeah, it's basically here it's 0.055 based on the p-value. So again, you know, all of this numerology is a little bit dependent on how you define the asymmetry and et cetera, et cetera. So what I want to show you are qualitative trends mostly. But basically, if that's the only observation that you have, is we have a measured value of asymmetry, what is your constraint on FNL? So this is the posterior. And it only cares about the magnitude of FNL. It doesn't care about the sign, because if you flip the sign, it's just over density, under density, whatever. It doesn't care. So you can see that if you have zero asymmetry, that's this black dashed curve, that strongly prefers a Gaussian universe. But as your value of the asymmetry grows, that starts to prefer, be more consistent with a non-zero value of FNL. So this dashed blue line here, we're claiming, is roughly what corresponds to the observed CMB level. And if all you do is say, I'm replacing, you know, I want to quantify the significance of this model, basically this rules out non-zero FNL at about a 3-sigma level, right? All I've done is replace the parameter of asymmetry A with my parameter FNL, and I want to ask, you know, what did I gain? Well, I didn't really gain anything, right? I just told you how likely non-zero FNL is, but you already knew that in some sense. There is an asymmetry. Sorry. No. And on the other hand, you might say, well, the values of FNL that you prefer are quite enormous. So we know that that's wrong, right? We haven't measured that value of FNL.
But it's 3 sigma.
Sorry. That rules out FNL 0 at 3 sigma, roughly. That value.
The ratio of something like percent or something like that.
The ratio of?
I mean, like the value at 0.
So going by the p-value, I haven't showed you the plot of the p-values. So I'm going to add the constraints from the bispectrum, but just from the large scale. So this model is wrong for two reasons. It's wrong because it doesn't give you the scale dependence of the power asymmetry. And it's wrong because if you take the average, you know, the measured value of FNL well from Planck, that's constrained to be very, very small. And this prefers a larger value. So let me think about correcting both of those things at the same time and just put in the large scale constraints on FNL, because I know that I'm going to have to correct this model so that it's scale dependent. So let me just use large-scale bispectrum constraints. So the power asymmetry is a large-scale thing, you know, L less than of order 160, something like that. So let me put in the large-scale bispectrum constraints, thanks to people in this room. They haven't changed that much, WMAP 5. And if we've read the plot correctly, we get some number like this. And we're, maybe. Some number.
I don't trust these guys.
Okay, good. then it all goes to hell. But if we pretend we trust these guys, then we actually see that the bound at large scales is much looser for FNL local. So let's use that additional information and now calculate the posterior for FNL. And what happens? Well, you know, you cut out this really large FNL stuff and you move down somewhere into here into FNLs of order a couple hundred, basically. Let me just make one note. A couple hundred, you say, okay, that's still pretty big, right? So basically, in order for me to get this asymmetry from something like a 2-sigma fluctuation of that long wavelength mode, right, which is much better than a 10-sigma fluctuation, you have to still use FNL of maybe 200. Maybe that's a 2-sigma fluctuation from that measured value, and maybe that's a little bit odd. That still adds up to some 2 2-sigmas, which is a 3-sigma, whatever. You can do much better if you use a mixed inflaton-curviton model, where part of the power is coming from a nonlinear field, and the rest of the power is coming from a linear field, essentially. Then you win by factor square root of the power in the curviton. So basically, you make the second field much more non-Gaussian, but the filtered effect is that we see an effect of lower non-Gaussianity in our sky. So this would let you cut down the needed value of the observed FNL down to 150, something like that. Lets you cut that down. Of course, there's a price. What you're actually secretly doing is making that curviton field very non-Gaussian. And at some level, that doesn't work, so you have some restriction. Xc has to be bigger than the amplitude of the asymmetry for this to be the right equation. This, of course, isn't just some magical free parameter that you get for free. This thing is constrained by other observables, tensor to scalar ratio, large scale structure stochasticity. So it's not just a magic parameter that lets me get something for nothing. It's actually constrainable by other stuff, so that's good.
Why does psi have to do with tensor to scalar
ratio? Because it changes the scalar power, not the tensor.
Does it depend on, to get any tensor, you need higher scale inflation. So I'm a bit confused. If you have lower scale inflation, there's no tensor.
Just saying that this change, that the power that comes from the inflaton is only a part of this. And that gives you all of the tensor modes, but only some of the scalar modes.
Okay. Okay, I think it's the size constraint. But
you just think you have trouble accommodating
larger. Yes, exactly. Sorry, exactly.
You have trouble accommodating larger.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So then the question is, okay, do you actually have any evidence for this model? So because we have these probability distributions for the isotropies, when am I supposed to stop? 40, right? Okay, good. Starting to check my time. Okay. We can actually just go ahead and compute the likelihood ratios of the two models. We can take the reduced case when our model has FNL zero. This reduces to the Gaussian thing and compute the ratio of preference for the non-Gaussian model as a function of A observed. So again, this is just telling you that if the asymmetry is really small, if this number, this log is positive, it prefers the Gaussian model. If the asymmetry grows, at some point it starts to prefer the non-Gaussian model, but only weakly. So either, you know, there's some scale that you can try to assign to how good of evidence this is for the non-Gaussian model or not. The upshot is that this is relatively weak, at best, evidence for the model. And again, that's not that surprising. We've introduced one parameter to explain one measurement, which is a 3-sigma fluctuation. So why would we ever have particularly strong evidence for this model over the Gaussian case? Okay. Okay, so let's try to do a little bit better. So the power asymmetry that's observed is scale dependent. The local ansatz is actually special in the fact that it is scale independent. It says that all small scale modes couple to long wavelength modes with the same strength. The power asymmetry dies off at small scales, which just says if this is the sort of explanation you're doing, then you want small scale stuff to couple more weakly to the long wavelength mode than modes of comparable scale to the horizon scale do. So that's basically any shape of non-Gaussianity except exactly local. For example, that's exactly what scale independent equilateral and orthogonal do, right? Here I'm using orthogonal to mean the degree of coupling in the squeeze limit. Those things couple small scale modes more weakly to long scale modes than local does. And most of the coupling is in modes of comparable size. So that means that if I have a large scale gradient, which is this special mode, mostly the modes that care about that are modes of order the horizon scale. So this is a scale independent bispectrum, but because it basically just tells you that small scale modes couple more weakly to the gradient than large scale modes do, that gives you this fall off with scale for the asymmetry. These fall offs are much too steep, and the amplitude of these FNLs that you need, I think even considering scale, large scale constraints, are much, much bigger comparably. This may not be that great of a model, but the point here is just that I actually aren't doing anything weird by building scale dependence into this anomaly. I'm just moving away from this very special scale invariant local model. So scale dependent modulations, what does it look like? So again, you take your model with whatever correlation functions, you can compute this thing. For sort of phenomenological purposes, there are basically two types of scale dependence that matter here. One is, how strongly does the short scale mode, the one that you're measuring, couple to this background stuff? So that I'm going to capture with NF. If that thing's less than zero, dipole modulation decreases as a function of scale. Basically says, longer wavelength things here have a smaller amplitude coupling to this long wavelength background than long wavelength things do. The other thing that you can do, and especially if you have a scale invariant bispectrum, right, you don't get this without some other long wavelength dependence, is that this is the dependence on the long wavelength mode. So in the local model, there's just nothing here. As you deviate from the local ansatz, let's say you do the equilateral model, you get two factors of k here, which tell you that small k long wavelength mode contributions are super suppressed even for the monopole. And vice versa, if you make that thing negative, you can get even a dipole that's infrared divergent, not just a monopole. So the other thing that's nice about mixed scenarios is that it's perfectly reasonable that the nonlinear field has a different power spectrum than the inflaton contribution. That gives you a scale dependence. So that's another nice thing about the two. It's sort of a natural way to get it.
So, because you don't want dipole to be infrared divergent.
I don't know. If you want to argue that you get a bigger asymmetry, not because you have a big FNL, but because you have a big integral here, then you do.
Observe a CMB dipole and it's finite. So.
No, sorry. This is the amplitude of the modulation. It doesn't mean divergent, right? Because really, there's always something that cuts it off. I just mean sensitive to more infrared scales. Right. It's just that how big is the variance, basically?
Okay.
So if you want a bigger variance, you can either ramp up the coupling or you can ramp up this integral. And there are models in the literature that try to do both those things. Of course, if you try to do that, ramp up that coupling, it goes the wrong way for the dipole modulation. So you don't want to do a scale invariant version of that. So we're going to basically only include one new piece of data. So I'm going to stick with a model that has just one new parameter. I'm going to leave that infrared coupling alone and just use the same as coupling essentially as the local model, and just let the short wavelength FNL depend on k. This has been constrained. The constraints are very weak on this type of model, but here they are. This NFNL is, some number between, minus 0.1 and minus 1 and plus 1. The interesting thing about this model is that now the monopole shift is actually interesting. If you say that FNL dies off on small scales, then the power spectrum that you see on small scales is essentially the B background power spectrum. But large scale modes inside our horizon see the effect of these long wavelength modes. So their power spectrum is shifted, which means that on large scales, I get a shift in the power, but on small scales, I don't. So basically, what was a constant here, FNL, is now scale dependent. This is FNL of k. So in that sense, I might not be surprised to get a power suppression or enhancement on large scales, but not on small scales. That comes along with this model for free. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that now I can take information about power suppression on large scales and the dipole and use those both to constrain my non-Gaussian model. So to do this really correctly as an analysis would be more complicated than we wanted to do. So here we've just taken an example case, and there are some works on scale dependence. So this is designed to match some, to be easily read off some tables of some other works in the literature, but basically, as a function of L, we're saying FNL is 50, and then we've chosen this coefficient to die off pretty steeply as a function of L. So FNL dies off. This is L here for all these plots. So FNL dies off very quickly as a function of L.
So, sorry,
yes.
Why 0.64?
So basically, there are various papers in the literature that analyze some of these effects. This was a choice that you can easily go to a different paper that has some analysis and read off. So, you know, whatever. And it's just going to illustrate the points, which is FNL falls off quickly with scale. The expected amplitude of the dipole modulation, so this is the variance from the non-Gaussian part of one of those components, AI, falls off quickly with scale. The variance of the monopole shift falls off quickly with scale. So you expect a shift, a large-scale enhancement or suppression of power. You expect a large-scale dipole in power, and actually higher-order moments. But the higher-order moments are rapidly suppressed with L, so you actually don't expect to get probably that much evidence from higher-order modulation moments than you do from the monopole and the dipole. So then you can go through the same game, right? You can say, okay, now if I just use this stuff to constrain FNL, what happens? And if I use this to try to, if I try to ask, is there evidence for my model, what happens? So if we use this to constrain FNL, and now for simplicity, what we've done is we've, instead of showing you a variety of cases for the dipole, we've just picked the value of the dipole, which we think most closely corresponds to the observed value. And we're using now the additional information that there is some, on large scales, there is some power modulation as well, some isotropic power modulation, A0. So you can...
What data set do you use for that?
So in the sense of what is the value of that? So here we're just choosing these values, and you have to choose, you have to decide which one you think corresponds to the best fit to the CMB. But because what we have is a distribution, a probability distribution for A0 and AI, I can give you the posteriors without telling you.
So I guess what is the A0 for CMB?
Yeah, and so that's even a harder comparison to make, right? So we can show you the plots of the amp. I don't know, maybe someone has a good answer. It's of this order, but I don't know what the best, again, we have a simplified simulation and all that. So this is just to try to get across the point that if you use this information, you help your constraint of the model. So if you don't use it, this is the scale. This is now a log scale for size of FNL. If you don't use any monopole information, again, you prefer to have these very large values of FNL. If you do use that, and the monopole shift takes size, let's say 0.02, so smallish, you start to get a little peak for smaller values of FNL. So that, in other words, is a smallish isotropic power modulation. If your modulation gets a little bit bigger, this thing, remember, is sensitive to how many e-folds of inflation you have. So it's going to change as you have different numbers of e-folds of inflation. And the bispectrum constraint is still what we're using to cut off these very large values of FNL. So this thing kind of walks around in parameter space. And unfortunately, it now depends on how many e-folds of inflation you have, because that monopole is infrared sensitive. So that's affecting the expected size of your monopole. So as you add more e-folds of inflation, for a fixed FNL, the variance of your monopole gets bigger. So if you see a small monopole, that's less likely. So there's this sort of walking around in space. We can go through that again if you want. But that's the constraints that you get on FNL. OK, so now what we've done is we've added in one parameter, which is this scale dependence. We fixed that to some value. We're adding in one other data, which is the value of the isotropic modulation on large scales. And now you can ask, is there any evidence for this model? And again, we've just done some range of cases. And you can show that this bottoms out at something that's at most sort of moderate evidence for this non-Gaussian model over the Gaussian. But in principle, you can measure the parameters of the bispectrum much better, right? Here we haven't done anything about constraints on the shape of the bispectrum too much. So in principle, we've added this extra parameter, which gives you information about the shape of the bispectrum on smaller scales. So the question is, given that you have that, maybe you want to have this mixed scenario where you want to constrain the ratio of couplings. Could you ever have enough data to provide evidence for this model? And I don't know, but I think what we're trying to say here is that there's a good reason to think about it a little more strongly. And you know, maybe once we have polarization data, and as was mentioned this morning, KSC, we could increase the significance of this modulation. Is it really there or not? That would help. And then we'd like to constrain the shape a little bit better. And probably what you really need is information on smaller scales, right? Stuff that's not so terribly cosmic variance limited that you're just going to be doing the same wash over and over again. And all this stuff has to fall off with scale. So whether you ever win at that game, I don't really know. Someone who's an expert at the data can tell me. The other thing that happens here, of course, is that we do have, it's not a big super horizon mode, but we do have a super horizon mode. So there is also a GZ effect just from that long wavelength mode. Forget the coupling, forget the modulation, which in principle is aligned with these modulations. Now, can you pull that out? I have no idea. So it's just the fact that if you have a long wavelength mode in K space, that thing gets filtered down into the power spectrum in L space. So this was used a long time ago to constrain, you know, how many E-folds we could have without having some order one fluctuation in the background. It's basically just saying, forgetting the non-Gaussianity, what's the effect of a really large mode outside the horizon? Because when you do CLs, you're integrating actually over K space. That's filtered in, but okay. So I don't know, but I think the conclusions basically are that, especially if you have a non-Gaussian model, when you consider evidence for that model, you should do what looks to us like anisotropy together with the non-Gaussianity, because those things come hand in hand. You expect to have more significant modulations in a non-Gaussian model than in a Gaussian model. So you might as well use all of that information. The other thing is, I think this scale-dependent non-Gaussian model, whether you can have any evidence for it, we remain to be seen, is very appealing in a way, because you could fit the bispectrum, you could fit these anomalies, and it's not weird, right? Once you accept scale-dependent non-Gaussianity, which is basically anything except the local ansatz, then it's a matter of fitting the scale dependence and blah, blah, blah. But I don't have to invoke any special scale or any special physics on sub-horizon scales. I just have basically normal, I can do the normal cosmic variance with the normal power spectrum extrapolated to large scales and see what I get, see if that's a good fit or not. The other point is that, which I already made, I guess, is that scale dependence of this modulation is generic, right? Exact local ansatz is a little bit weird in some respects. It's exactly scale independent for all the coupling. Anything else you have is going to couple different scales differently and will give you some scale dependence to your anisotropy. This curvaton-inflaton scenario might look pretty good. I don't know if you're an aficionado of that model. It gives you natural scale dependence, maybe naturally small non-Gaussianity on large scales, and is not particularly special. You might ask, well, why is it that FNL is order 100 on our horizon scale and not something else? Maybe that's a fine-tuning, but it's of a different sort than asking, why is there a special scale just lurking outside of our horizon scale? So I think it's well worth going back and doing a more formal analysis of this to evaluate how these anomalies look in light of relatively innocuous non-Gaussian models. Okay, thanks.
Maybe time for one question for Sarah. Can we move on? Yeah, so as you say, in principle, this hemispherical power symmetry. Now, you can just another way of thinking of like a special trispectrum, like a support pattern, right? So, the principle like isn't like observationally rather than trying to fit this way. You just measure by you just predict. It's a prediction for a particular bispectrum, right? But my point is that if you want to measure this, you need to pixelize your thing into kind of a small pixels, measure the power spectrum each of them, feed dipole, right? Then you have all this, you know, how big my pixels are. But if you measure like a four-point function, if you just measure a particular contraction four-point function, and then you kind of optimal, and then you don't even need to go through this thing. You can just go straight from like, this is my inflationary model, my non-Gaussian inflationary model. This is prediction for the four-point function, right?
Yeah, sure. I can give you all of that. But it basically is going to operate the same way, right? I want to give you a probability distribution for the anisotropies that you see. So whichever direction you take to calculate that, it's going to look like this, but yeah. And I guess naively, if all you had was FNL, you might think that this is an order FNL squared effect, because the trispectrum just from FNL is order FNL squared, and it's not, it's order FNL.
Okay.
So that might be one.
Okay,
this way. Okay, thanks, Sarah.